You know this is dangerous.
That's why I'm doing it, Mark.
She hadn't seen him look so furious since Kieran had come riding up to the Institute with Irloth and Gwyn. She felt a small, secret pulse of excitement inside her chest that she could make him look that angry. They hate shadow hunters here, don't you remember? He said. They don't know I'm a shadow hunter. Believe me, said Mark, leaning in close so that she could feel his breath hot against her ear. They know.
Then they don't care, said Christina. It's a revel. I've read about these. Fairies lose themselves in music like humans. They dance and they forget, just like us.
Mark's hands curved around her waist. It was a protective gesture, she told herself. It didn't mean anything, but her pulse quickened regardless. When Mark had first arrived at the Institute, he had been stick-thin, hollow-eyed. Now she could feel muscle over his bones, the hard strength of him against her. I never asked you, he said as they moved among the crowd. They were close to two girls dancing together. Both of them had their black hair bound up in elaborate crowns of berries and acorns. They wore dresses of russet and brown, ribbons around their slim throats, and swished their skirts away from Mark and Christina, laughing at the couple's clumsiness. Christina didn't mind. Why fairies? Why did you make that the thing you studied?
Because of you.
She tilted her head back to look up at him, saw the surprise that passed across his expressive face, the beginning of the gentle curves of wonder at the corners of his mouth.
Because of you, Mark Blackthorne.
Me? His lips shaped the word.
I was in my mother's rose garden when I heard what had happened to you, she said. I was only 13. The Dark War was ending, and the Cold Peace had been announced. The whole Shadowhunter world knew of your sister's exile, and that you had been abandoned. My great-uncle came out to tell me about it. My family always used to joke that I was soft-hearted, and it was easy to make me cry. And he knew I'd been worrying about you, so he told me, he said, "Your lost boy will never be found now."
Mark swallowed. Emotions passed like storm clouds behind his eyes. Not for him, Julian's guardedness, his shields.
And did you?
Did I what?
Did you cry? He said.
They were still moving together, in the dance, but it was almost mechanical now. Christina had forgotten the steps her feet were taking. She was aware only of Mark's breathing, her fingers locked behind Mark's neck, Mark in her arms.
I did not cry, Christina said, but I did decide that I would dedicate myself to eradicating the Cold Peace. It was not a fair law then. It will never be a fair law.
His lips parted.
Christina.
A voice, like doves, interrupted them, soft, feathery, and light. It crooned,
"Drinks, madame and sir, something to cool you after dancing?"
A fairy with a face like a cat's, furred and whiskered, stood before them in the tatters of an Edwardian suit. He held a gold plate on which were many small glasses containing liquids of different colors, blue, red, and amber.
"Is it enchanted?"
Christina said breathlessly.
"Will it give me strange dreams?"
"It will cool your thirst, lady," said the fairy, "and all I ask for in return is a smile from your lips."
Christina seized up the glass full of amber fluid. It tasted of passion fruit, sweet and tart. She took one swallow, and Mark dashed the glass from her hand. It fell tinkling at their feet, splashing his hand with liquid. He licked the fluid from his skin, glaring at her all the while. Christina backed away. She could feel a pleasant warmth spreading in her chest. The drinks seller was snapping at Mark, who pushed him away with a coin, a mundane penny, and started after Christina.
"Stop," he said. "Christina, slow down. You're going toward the center of the revel. The music will always be stronger there."
She stopped, held out a hand to him. She felt fearless. She knew she ought to be terrified. She had swallowed a fairy drink, and anything might happen. But instead, she felt as if she were flying. She was soaring free, only Mark here to tether her to the ground.
"Dance with me," she said.
He caught at her. He looked angry still, but he held her tightly, nonetheless.
You've had enough dancing and drinking.
Enough dancing?
It was the girls in russet again, their red mouths, laughing. Other than their different colored eyes, they looked nearly identical. One of them pulled the ribbon from around her throat. Christina stared. Her neck was horribly scarred, as if her head had nearly been severed from her body.
Dance together,
the girl said, nearly spat it, as if it were a curse, and looped the ribbon around Mark and Christina's wrists, binding them together.
Enjoy the binding, hunter.
She grinned at Mark, and her teeth were black, as if they'd been painted that color, and sharp as needles. Christina gasped, stumbled back, pulling Mark after her, the ribbon connecting them. It stretched like a rubber band, not breaking or fraying. Mark caught up to her, seizing her hand in his fingers threaded through hers. He drew her after him, fast and sure-footed on the uneven terrain, finding the breaks in the heavy mist. They pushed between dancing couples until the grass under them was no longer trampled and the music was faint in their ears. Mark veered to the side, making for a copse of trees. He slipped under the branches, holding the low-hanging ones aside to let Christina in after him. Once she had ducked underneath, he released them, closing them both into a dirt-floored space beneath the trees, hidden from the outside world by long branches laden with fruit that touched the ground. Mark sat down, drawing a knife from his belt. "Come here," he said, and when Christina came to sit beside him, he took her hand and slashed apart the ribbon binding them. It made a little shrieking, hurt sound, like a wounded animal that frayed and gave. He let go of Christina and dropped the knife. Faint sunlight filtered down through the branches above, and in the dim illumination, the ribbon still around his wrist looked like blood. The ribbon was looped around Christina's wrist as well, no longer burning, trailing its lonely end in the dirt. She worried at it with her nails until it came free and fell to the ground. Her fingers kept slipping, probably the fairy drink still in her system, she thought. She glanced over at Mark. His face was drawn, his gold and blue eyes shadowed. "That could have been very bad," he said, casting the rest of his ribbon aside. "A binding spell like that can tie two people together and send one of them mad, make one of them drown themselves, and pull the other in after them."
"Mark," Christina said, "I'm sorry. I should have listened to you. You know more about revels than I do. You have experience. I only have the books I read."
"No," he said unexpectedly. "I wanted to go, too. I like dancing with you.
It was good to be there with someone human," Christina said.
The heat in her chest had turned into a strange pinching feeling, a hot pressure that increased when she looked at him. The curves of his cheekbones, the hollows of his temples. His loose, wheat-colored shirt was open at the throat, and she could see that place she had always thought was the most beautiful spot on the man's body, the smooth muscle over the clavicle and the vulnerable hollow.
"Yes, human," he said. "We are all human, I know. But I have almost never known anyone as human as you."
Christina felt breathless. The fairy mist had stolen her breath, she thought. That and the enchantment all around them.
"You are kind," he said. "One of the kindest people I have known. In the hunt, there was not much kindness. When I think that when the sentence of the cold peace was passed, there was someone 1,000 miles away from Idris, someone who had never met me but who cried for a boy who had been abandoned."
"I said I didn't cry." Christina's voice hitched. Mark's hand was a pale blur. She felt his fingers against her face. They came away wet, shining in the mist light.
"You're crying now," he said.
When she caught at his hand, it was damp with her own tears. And when she leaned toward him through the mist and kissed him, she tasted salt. For a moment, Mark was startled, unmoving, and Christina felt a spear of terror go through her, worse than the sight of any demon, that Mark might not want this,
that he might be horrified. "Christina," he said, as she broke away from him, and went up on his knees, his arm coming around her a little awkwardly, his hand burying itself in her hair. "Christina," he said again, with a break in his voice, the rough sound of desire. She put her hands on either side of his face, her palms in the hollows of his cheeks, and marveled at the softness where Diego had had stubble, rough against her skin. She let him come to her this time, closing her into the circle of his left arm, fitting his mouth to hers. Stars exploded behind her eyelids. Not just any stars, but the many-colored stars of Faerie. She saw clouds and constellations. She tasted night air on his mouth. His lips moved frantically against hers. He was still whispering her name, incoherent between kisses. His free hand slid over her waist, up her side. He groaned when her fingers found their way into the neck of his shirt and brushed along his collarbone, touched the beating pulse in his throat. He said something in a language she didn't know, and then he was flat on the ground, and she was over him, and he was pulling her down, hands fierce on her back and her shoulders, and she wondered if this was how it had always been for him with Kieran, fierce and ungentle. She remembered seeing them kiss in the desert behind the Institute, and how it had been a frantic thing, a clash of bodies, and it had sparked desire in her then, and it did again now. He arched up, and she heard him gasp as she slid down his body, kissing his throat, and then his chest through his shirt, and then her fingers were on his buttons, and she heard him laugh breathlessly, saying her name, and then, "I never thought you'd even look at me. Not someone like you, Shadow Hunter royalty, like a princess." "It's amazing what a bit of enchanted fairy drink will do." She meant to sound teasing, light-hearted, but Mark went still under her. A moment later he had moved, quick and graceful, and was sitting at least a foot from her, his hands up as if to hold her away. "Fairy drink?" he echoed. Christina looked at him in surprise. "The sweet drink the cat-faced man gave to me. You tasted it?" "There was nothing in it," Mark said with uncharacteristic sharpness. "I knew the moment I put my lips to my skin. It was only brambleberry juice, Christina." Christina recoiled slightly, both from his anger and from the realization that there had been no blurring cloak of magic over the thing she'd just done. "But I thought..." "You thought you were kissing me because you were intoxicated," Mark said. "Not because you wanted to, or because you actually liked me." "But I do like you." She rose to her knees, but Mark was already on his feet. "I have, since I met you." "Is that why you got together with Diego?" Mark said, and then shook his head, backing up. "Maybe I can't do this." "Do what?" Christina staggered upright. "Be with a human who lies," Mark said, uninflected. "But you have lied too," said Christina. "You've lied about being with Emma, and you've taken part in the same lie." "Because it has to be told," Christina said, "for both their sakes. If Julian wasn't in love with her, then he wouldn't need to think—" She broke off then as Mark went white in the shadows. "What did you say?" Christina put her hand to her mouth. The fact of Emma and Julian's feelings for each other was so rooted in what she knew about them that it was hard to remember others didn't know. It was so clear in their every word and gesture, even now. How could Mark not know? "But they're parabatai," he said, bewildered. "It's illegal. The punishment. Julian wouldn't. He just wouldn't." "I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have said anything. I was just guessing." "You weren't guessing," Mark said and turned away from her, shoving his way out through the branches of the trees. Christina went after him. He had to understand. He couldn't say anything to Julian. Her betrayal weighted her heart like a stone, her sense of humiliation forgotten in her fear for Emma, her realization of what she'd done. She pushed through the tree branches, the dry-edged leaves scratching her skin. A moment later, she was outside on a green hill, and she saw Julian. The music woke Jules. The music and the enveloping sense of warmth. He hadn't been warm in so long, not even at night,
huddled in blankets. He blinked his eyes open. He could hear music in the distance, weaving feathery tendrils across the sky. He turned his head to the side and saw with a jolt of familiarity Emma beside him, her head on her jacket. Their hands were clasping on the grass between them, his tanned fingers wrapped tightly around her smaller ones. He drew his hand back fast, his heart pounding, and scrambled to his feet. He wondered if he'd reached out for her in his sleep, or had she reached for him? No, she wouldn't have reached out for him. She had Mark. She might have kissed him, Julian, but it was Mark's name, she'd said. He thought he would be all right, sleeping this close to her, but apparently he'd been wrong. His hand still felt as if it were burning, but the rest of his body was cold again. Emma murmured and turned, her blonde hair falling over her hand, now curled palm up on the grass as if she were reaching out for him. He couldn't stand it. He seized his jacket up off the ground, shrugged it on, and went to look out from the hill. Maybe he could tell how close they were to the foot of the mountains, how long it would take them to reach the Unseelie Court and end this insane mission. Not that he blamed Mark. He didn't. Kieran was like family to Mark, and Julian understood family better than he understood almost anything else. But he was already worried about the children at the Institute, whether they would be furious, panicked, unforgiving. He never left them before. Never. The wind changed, and the music picked up. Julian found himself at the edge of the hill looking down at a vista of green grass, dotted here and there with copses of trees that swept down to a cleared space where a blur of color and movement was visible. Dancers. They were moving in time to the thrum of a music that seemed to well up from inside the earth. It was insistent, demanding. It called to you to join it, to be swept up and carried, the way that a wave might carry you from sea to shore. Julian felt the pull, though it was distant enough not to be uncomfortable. His fingers ached for his paintbrushes, though. Everywhere he looked, he saw an intensity of color and movement that made him wish he was in his studio in front of his easel. He felt as if he were looking at pictures where the colors had been adjusted for maximum saturation. The leaves and grass were intently, almost poisonously green. Fruit was brighter than jewelry. The birds that dipped and dove through the air had plumage so wildly colorful it made Julian wonder if nothing here hunted them, if they had no other purpose but beauty and display. "What's wrong?" He turned around and saw her just behind him on the ridge of the hill. Emma, her long hair untied and flying around her like a sheet of metal hammered thin. His heart lurched, feeling a pull far more insistent than that of fairy music. "Nothing." His voice came out rougher than he'd intended. "Just looking for Mark and Christina. Once I find them, we should go. We've got a lot more walking to do." She moved toward him, her expression wistful. The sun was raying down through the clouds, lightening her hair to rich waves of saffron. Julian clenched his hand tightly, refusing to let himself raise his fingers, to bury them in the pale hair that Emma usually undid only at night. That spoke to Julian of the moments of peace between twilight and nightfall, when the children were asleep and he was alone with Emma. Moments of soft speech and intimacy that far predated any realization on his part that they were anything more than parabatai. In the curve of her sleeping face, in the fall of her hair, in the shadows of her lashes against her cheeks, was a peace he had only rarely known. "Did you hear the music?" she asked, taking a step closer, close enough to touch. Julian wondered if this was how drug addicts felt, wanting what they knew they shouldn't have, thinking, "Just this once won't matter." "Emma, don't," he said. He didn't know what he was asking exactly. "Don't be close to me. I can't bear it. Don't look at me like that. Don't be everything I want and can't have. Don't make me forget your marks. In any way, you could never be mine." "Please," she said.
She looked at him with wide, pained eyes. Please, I need... The part of Julian that could never withstand being needed unlocked his clenched hands, his braced feet. He was inside the sphere of her presence in seconds, their bodies almost colliding. He put a hand against her cheek. She wasn't wearing Cortana, he noticed, with a distant puzzlement. Why had she left it behind? Her eyes flashed. She raised herself onto her toes, tilting up her face. Her lips moved, but he couldn't hear what she was saying over the roaring in his own ears. He remembered being knocked down by a wave once, pressed to the bottom of the ocean, breathless and unable to get up. There had been a terror in it, but also a sense of letting go. Something more powerful was carrying him, and he no longer needed to fight. Her arms were around his neck, her lips on his, and he let go, surrendering. His whole body contracted, his heart racing, exploding, veins thrumming with blood and energy. He caught her up against him, small and strong in his arms. He gasped, unable to breathe, tasting the sweet sharpness of blood. But not Emma. He couldn't taste Emma. The familiarity of her, and the scent of her, was different, too. Gone was the sweetness of sun-warmed skin, of the herbs in her soap and shampoo, the scent of gear and gold and girl. You don't grow up with someone, dream of them, let them shape your soul and put their fingerprints on your heart, and not know when the person you were kissing wasn't them. Julian yanked himself away, wiping the back of his hand across his mouth. Blood smeared his knuckles. He was looking at a fairy woman, her skin smooth and pale, an unmarked, unwrinkled canvas. She was grinning, her lips red. Her hair was the color of cobwebs. It was cobwebs, gray and fine and drifting. She could have been any age at all. Her only clothes were a ragged black shift. She was beautiful, and also hideous.
"You delight me, Shadow Hunter," she crooned. "Will you not come back to my arms for more kisses?"
She reached out. Julian stumbled back. He had never in his life kissed anyone but Emma. He felt sick now, in his heart and guts. He wanted to reach for a seraph blade, to burn the air between them, to feel the familiar heat race up his arms and through his veins to cauterize his nausea. His hand had only just closed around the hilt of the blade when he remembered. It wouldn't work here.
"Leave him alone," someone shouted. "Get away from my brother, Leon and she."
It was Mark. He was emerging from a copse of trees with Christina just behind him. There was a dagger in his hand. The fairy woman laughed.
"Your weapons will not work in this realm, Shadow Hunter."
There was a click, and Christina's folding knife bloomed open in her hand.
"Come and speak your words of challenge to my blade, Barrow Woman."
The fairy pulled back with a hiss, and Julian saw his own blood on her teeth. He felt lightheaded with sickness and anger. She whirled and was gone in a moment, a gray-black blur racing down the hill. The music had stopped. The dancers, too, had begun to scatter. The sun was setting, the shadows thick across the ground. Whatever kind of revel it had been, it was one that apparently was not friendly to nightfall.
"Julian, brother,"
Mark hurried forward, his eyes concerned. "You look ill. Sit down, drink some water." A soft whistle came from farther up the hill. Julian turned. Emma was standing on the ridge, buckling on Cortana. He saw the relief on her face as she caught sight of them.
"I wondered where you'd gone," she said, hurrying down the hill.
Her smile as she looked at them all was hopeful.
"I was worried you'd eaten fairy fruit and were running naked around the greensward."
"No nudity," said Julian. "No greensward." Emma tightened the strap on Cortana. Her hair had been pulled back into a long braid, only a few pale tendrils escaping. She looked around at the tense faces, her brown eyes wide.
"Is everything okay?"
Julian could still feel the fingerprints of the Leon and she all over him. He knew what Leon and she were. Wild fairies who took the shape of whatever you wanted to see, seduced you, and fed on your blood and skin.
At least he was the only one who would have seen Emma. Mark and Christina would have seen the Leoninchi in her true form. That was one humiliation and danger spared them all. "Everything's fine," he said. "We better get going. The stars are just coming out, and we've got a long way still to go."
"All right," Livy said, pausing in front of a narrow wooden door.
It didn't look much like the rest of the Institute, glass and metal and modernity. It seemed like a warning.
"Here we go."
She didn't look eager. They decided, with Kit mostly as a silent onlooker, to go directly to Arthur Blackthorne's office. Even if it was 2 in the morning, even if he didn't want to be bothered with Centaurian business, he needed to know what Zara was planning. She was after the Institute, Livy had explained as they scrambled back along the beach and rocks to where they'd started. Surely that's why she'd said what she had about Arthur. Clearly she'd tell any lie. Kit had never thought about institutes much. They'd always struck him as something like police stations, buzzy hives of shadow hunters meant to keep an eye on specific locations. It seemed they were more like small city-states, in charge of a certain area but run by a family appointed by the council in Idris. "There's seriously an entire private country that's just shadow hunters?" Kit demanded as they headed up the road to the Institute, rising like a shadow against the mountains behind it.
"Yes," said Livy tersely. In other words, shut up and listen.
Kit had the feeling she was processing what was happening by explaining it to him. He shut up and let her. An Institute was run by a head whose family lived with him or her. They also housed families who'd lost members or Nephilim orphans, of whom there were many. The head of an Institute had significant power. Most consuls were chosen from that pool, and they could propose new laws, which would be passed if a vote went their way. All Institutes were just as empty as the Los Angeles one. In fact, it was unusually crowded at the moment, due to the Centaurian presence. They were meant to be that way, in case they needed to house a battalion of shadow hunters at any moment. There was no staff, as there was no need of one. Shadow hunters who worked for the Institute, called the Conclave, were spread out all over the city in their own houses. Not that there were many of them, either, Livy added grimly. So many had died in the war 5 years ago. But if Zara's father were to become head of the Los Angeles Institute, not only would he be able to propose his bigoted law, but the Blackthorns would be thrown out on their ears with nowhere to go but Idris.
"Is Idris so bad?" Kit had asked as they went up the stairs.
Not that he wanted to be shipped off to Idris. He was just getting used to the Institute. Not that he'd want to stay in it if Zara's father took over. Not if he was anything like Zara. Livy glanced at Ty, who hadn't interrupted her during her tirade.
"Idris is fine, great, even, but this is where we live."
They'd reached the door to Arthur's office then, and everything had gone silent. Kit wondered if he should just lead the way. He didn't care particularly if he annoyed Arthur Blackthorne or not. Ty looked at the door with troubled eyes.
"We're not supposed to bother Uncle Arthur. We promised Jules."
"We have to," Livy said simply, and pushed the door open. A narrow set of stairs led to a shadowy room under the eaves of the house. There was a cluster of desks, each with a lamp on it. So many lamps the room was filled with brilliance. Every book, every piece of paper with scrawled writing, every plate with half-eaten food on it, was harshly illuminated. A man sat at one of the desks. He wore a long bathrobe over a ragged sweater and jeans. His feet were bare. The robe had probably once been blue, but was now a sort of dirty white from many washings. He was clearly a Blackthorn. His mostly gray hair curled like Julian's did, and his eyes were a brilliant blue-green. They went past Livy and Ty and fastened on Kit.
"Stephen," he said and dropped the pen he was holding. It hit the ground, spilling ink in a dark pool over the floorboards.
Livy's mouth was partly open. Ty was pressed against the wall.
"Uncle Arthur, that's Kit," said Livy.
Kit Herondale. Arthur chuckled dryly. Herondale, indeed, he said. His eyes seemed to burn. There was a look of sickness in them, like a heat of a fever. He rose to his feet and came over to Kit, staring down into his face.
Why did you follow Valentine? He said. You, who had everything. Yea, is not even Apollo, with hair and harpstring of gold, a bitter god to follow? A beautiful god to behold?
He smelled bitter of old coffee. Kit took a step back.
What kind of Herondale will you be? Arthur whispered. William or Tobias? Stephen or Jace? Beautiful, bitter, or both?
Uncle, said Ty. He pitched his voice loud, though it shook slightly. We need to talk to you about the Centaurians. They want to take the Institute. They don't want you to be head of it anymore. Arthur whirled on Ty with a fierce look, almost a glare, but not quite. Then he began to laugh.
Is that true? Is it?
He demanded. The laughter built and seemed to break into an almost sob. He whirled around and sat heavily down in his desk chair.
What a joke,
he said savagely. It's not a joke, Livy began.
They want to take the Institute from me, Arthur said. As if I hold it.
I've never run the Institute in my life, children. He does everything. Writes the correspondence, plans the meetings, speaks with the council.
Who does everything? Said Kit, though he knew he had no place in the conversation. Julian. The voice was Diana's. She was standing at the top of the attic stairs, looking around the room as if the brightness of the light surprised her. Her expression was resigned. He means Julian. Chapter 10. So Wills Its King. They were in Diana's office. Through the window, the ocean looked like rippled aluminum, illuminated by black light. I am sorry you had to learn this about your uncle, said Diana. She was leaning back against her desk. She wore jeans and a sweater, but still looked immaculate. Her hair was swept back into a mass of curls, clipped by a leather barrette. I had hoped, Julian had hoped, that you'd never know. Kit was leaning against the far wall. Ty and Livy sat on Diana's desk. Both of them looked stunned, as if they were recovering from having the wind knocked out of them. Kit had never been more conscious that they were twins, despite the difference in their coloring.
So, all these years, it's been Julian, said Livy, running the Institute, doing everything, covering up for Arthur.
Kit thought of his drive with Julian to the shadow market. He hadn't spent that much time with the second oldest Blackthorn boy, but Julian had always seemed terrifyingly adult to him, as if he were years older than his calendar age. We should have guessed. Ty's hand twisted and untwisted the slim white cords of the headphones looped around his neck. I should have figured it out. We don't see the things that are closest to us, said Diana. It's the nature of people.
But Jules, Livy whispered. He was only 12. It must have been so hard on him.
Her face shone. For a moment, Kit thought it was reflected light from the windows. Then he realized it was tears. He always loved you so much, said Diana. It was what he wanted to do. We need him here, said Ty. We need him here now. I should go, Kit said. He had never felt so uncomfortable. Well, maybe not never. There had been the incident with the 5 drunk werewolves and the cage of newts at the shadow market, but rarely. Livy looked up, her tear-stained face baleful. No, you shouldn't. You need to stay here and help us explain to Diana about Zara.
I didn't understand half of what she said, Kit protested, about institute heads and registries.
Ty took a deep breath. I'll explain, he said. The recitation of what had happened seemed to calm him down, the regular march of facts, one after another. When he was done, Diana crossed the room and double-locked the door. "Do either of the rest of you remember anything else?" Diana asked, turning back to them. "One thing," Kit said, surprised he actually had something to contribute. "Zara said the next council meeting was going to be soon." "I assume that's the one where they tell everyone about Arthur," said Livy, "and make their play for the Institute." "The Cohort is a powerful faction inside the Clave," said Diana. "They're a nasty bunch. They believe in interrogating any downworlders they find breaking the Accords with torture. They support the Cold Peace unconditionally. If I'd known Zara's father was one of them..." She shook her head. "Zara can't have the Institute," said Livy. "She can't. It's our home."
"She doesn't care about the Institute," said Kit. "She and her father want the power it can give."
He thought of the downworlders he knew at the Shadow Market, thought of them rounded up, forced to wear some kind of signs, branded or stamped with identification numbers. "The Cohort has the upper hand, though," said Livy. "She knows about Arthur, and we can't afford to have anyone find out." "She's right. They'll hand the Institute over to someone else."
"Is there anything you know about the Dearborns or the Cohort? Something that might discredit them?" said Kit. "Keep them from getting the Institute if it was up for grabs?"
"But we'd still lose the Institute," said Ty.
"Yeah," said Kit. "But they wouldn't be able to start registering downworlders. Maybe it doesn't sound that harmful, but it never stops there. Zara clearly doesn't care if downworlders live or die. Once she knows where they all are, once they have to report to her, the Cohort has power over them." He sighed. "You should really read some mundane history books."
"Maybe we could threaten her by saying we'll tell Diego," said Livy. "He doesn't know, and I know he was a jerk to Christina, but I can't believe he'd be okay with all this. If he knew, he'd dump Zara, and she doesn't want that." Diana frowned. "It is not our strongest position, but it is something." She turned to her desk, picked up a pen and notepad. "I'm going to write to Alec and Magnus. They head the Downworlder Shadow Hunter Alliance. If anyone knows about the Cohort, or any tricks we can use to defeat them, they will."
"And if they don't?"
"We try Diego," said Diana. "I wish I believed I could trust him more than I do, but..." She sighed. "I like him. But I liked Manuel, too. People are not what they seem."
"And do we keep telling everyone that Julian and the others went to the Academy?" Livy asked, sliding off the desk.
Her eyes were dark-rimmed with exhaustion. Ty's shoulders drooped. Kit felt a little as if he'd been hit with a sandbag himself.
"If anyone finds out they went to Ferry, it won't matter what we do about Zara. We'll lose the Institute anyway."
"We hope they come back soon," Diana said, looking out at the moon's reflection on the ocean water. "And if hoping doesn't work, we pray for it."
The woods had gone, and as twilight deepened into true night, the four Shadow Hunters trekked through a spectral land of green fields, separated by low stone walls. Every once in a while they would see another patch of the strange, blighted earth through the mist. Sometimes they would glimpse the shape of a town in the distance and fall silent, not wanting to attract attention. They had eaten what was left of their food back on the hill, though it wasn't much. Emma wasn't hungry, though. A snarl of misery had taken up residence in her stomach. She couldn't forget what she had seen when she'd woken up, alone, in the grass. Rising, she had looked around for Julian. He was gone, even the impression in the grass where he'd lain beside her fading. The air had been heavy and gray-gold, making her head buzz as she climbed up over the ridge, about to call Julian's name. Then she'd seen him, standing halfway down the hill, the dank air lifting his sleeves, the edges of his hair. He wasn't alone. A fairy girl in a black, ragged shift was with him. Her hair was the color of burnt rose petals, a sort of gray pink drifting around her shoulders. Emma thought the girl looked up at her for a moment and smiled. She might have imagined it, though. She knew she didn't imagine what happened next, when the fairy girl leaned into Jules and kissed him. She wasn't sure what she thought would happen. Some part of her expected Jules to push the girl away. He didn't. Instead, he put his arms around her and drew her in, his hand tangling in her shimmering hair. Emma's stomach turned itself inside out as he pressed her close. He held the fairy girl tightly, their mouths moving together, her hands sliding from his shoulders down his back. There was something almost beautiful about the sight, in a horrible way. It stabbed Emma through with the remembrance of what it had been like to kiss Jules herself. And there was no hesitancy in him, no reluctance, nothing held back, as if he were reserving any piece of himself for Emma. He gave himself up utterly to the kiss, and he was as beautiful doing it as the realization that she had really lost him now was awful. She thought she could actually feel her heart break, like a friable piece of china. The fairy girl had broken away, and then there had been Mark and Christina there, and Emma hadn't been able to watch what was happening. She'd turned away, crumpling into the grass, trying not to throw up. Her hands balled into fists against the ground. "Get up," she told herself fiercely. She owed that much to Jules. He'd hidden whatever pain he'd felt when she'd ended things between them. She owed it to him to do the same. Somehow she'd managed to get to her feet, plaster a smile on her face, speak normally when she came down the hill to join the others, nod as they sat and divided up food as the stars came out and Mark determined he could navigate by them, seem unconcerned as they set off, Julian beside his brother, and she and Christina behind them, following Mark down the winding, unmarked paths of fairy. The sky was radiant now, with multicolored stars, each blazing an individual path of pigment across the sky. Christina was uncharacteristically quiet, kicking at stones with the toe of her boot as she walked. Mark and Julian were up ahead of them, just far enough to be out of earshot. ¿Qué onda? Christina asked, looking sideways at Emma. Emma's Spanish was bad, but even she understood. What's going on?
Nothing.
She felt awful about lying to Christina, but worse about her own feelings. Sharing them would only make them seem more real.
Well, good, Christina said. Because I have something to tell you.
She took a deep breath.
I kissed Mark.
Whoa, said Emma, diverted.
Whoa, ho, ho.
Did you just say whoa, ho, ho?
I did,
Emma admitted. So is this like a high-five-slash-chest-bump situation, or an oh-my-God-what-are-we-gonna-do situation? Christina tugged nervously on her hair.
I don't know. I like him very much, but at first I thought I was only kissing him because of the fairy drink.
Emma gasped.
You drank fairy wine? Christina! That's how you black out and wake up the next day under a bridge with a tattoo that says, I love helicopters. It wasn't really wine, it was just juice.
Okay, okay, Emma lowered her voice. Do you want me to end things with Mark? I mean, you know, tell the family it's over?
But Julian,
Christina said, looking troubled.
What about him?
For a moment, Emma couldn't speak. She was remembering Julian as the pretty fairy girl had come through the grass toward him, the way she had put her hands on his body, the way his arms had locked across her back. She had never felt jealousy like that before. It still ached in her, like the scar of an old wound. She welcomed the pain in a strange way. It was pain she deserved, she thought. If Julian hurt, she should hurt too. And she had cut him free. He was free to kiss fairy girls and look for love and be happy. He was doing nothing wrong. She remembered what Tessa had told her, that the way to make Julian stop loving her was to make him think she didn't love him. To convince him. It seemed she had.
I think my whole charade with Mark has done what it needed to do, she said. So, if you want...
I don't know, Christina said. She took a deep breath.
I have to tell you something. Mark and I argued. I didn't mean to, but I...
Stop! It was Mark up ahead. He whirled, Julian beside him, and held out a hand toward them.
Do you hear that?
Emma strained her ears. She wished it was possible to rune herself. She missed the runes that improved speed and hearing and reflex. She shook her head. Mark had changed into what must have been his hunt clothes, darker and more ragged, and had even rubbed dirt into his hair and face. His two-colored eyes glittered in the twilight.
Listen, he said. It's getting louder.
And suddenly Emma could hear it.
Music.
A sort of music she'd never heard before. Eerie and tuneless. It made her nerves feel like they were wriggling under her skin.
The court is near, Mark said. Those are the king's pipers.
He plunged into the thicker woods alongside the path, turning only to call, "Come along!" to the others. They followed. Emma was conscious of Julian just ahead of her. He'd taken out a short sword and was using it to hack away the undergrowth. Piles of leaves and branches studded with small, blood-colored flowers tumbled at her feet. The music was louder now, and grew louder still as they passed through thick forest, the trees above them glimmering with will-o'-the-wisp lights. Multicolored lanterns hung from the branches, pointing the way toward the darkest part of the forest. The Unseelie Court appeared suddenly, a burst of louder music and bright lights that stung Emma's eyes after so long in the dark. She wasn't sure what she'd imagine when she'd tried to picture the Unseelie Court. A massive stone castle, perhaps, with a grim throne room. A dark jewel of a chamber at the top of a tower with a winding gray stair. She recalled the shadowy darkness of the City of Bones, the hush of the place, the chill in the air. But the Unseelie Court was outside, a number of tents and booths, not unlike the ones at the Shadow Market, clustered in a glade in a circle of thick trees. The main part of it was a massive draped pavilion, with banners of velvet on which was displayed the emblem of a broken crown stamped in gold, flying from every part of the structure. A single tall throne made of smooth, glimmering black stone sat in the pavilion. It was empty. The back was carved with the two halves of a crown, this time hanging above a moon and a sun. A few gentry fairies in dark cloaks were milling around in the pavilion near the throne. Their cloaks bore the crown insignia, and they wore thick gloves, like the one Christina had found at the ruins of Malcolm's house. Most were young. Some barely looked older than 14 or 15.
"The Unseelie King's sons," whispered Mark.
They were crouching behind a tumble of boulders, peering around the edges, weapons in hand. Some of them, anyway.
"Doesn't he have any daughters?" Emma muttered.
"He has no use for them," Mark said. "You see, he has girl children killed at birth."
Emma couldn't prevent a flinch of anger.
"Just let me get close to him," she whispered. "I'll show him what use girls are."
There was a sudden blare of music. The fairies in the area began to move toward the throne. They were brilliant in their finery, gold and green and blue and flame red. The men as brightly clothed as the women.
"It's almost time," said Mark, straining to see. "The king is calling the gentry to him."
Julian straightened, still hidden by the boulders. "Then we should move now. I'm going to see if we can get any closer to the pavilion." His short sword gleamed in the moonlight. "Christina," he said, "come with me." After a single startled moment, Christina nodded.
"Of course."
She took out her knife, sliding a quick, apologetic look toward Emma as she and Julian disappeared into the trees. Mark leaned forward against the massive boulder, blocking them from the view of the glade. He didn't look at Emma, only spoke in a low voice.
"I can't do this," he said. "I can no longer lie to my brother."
Emma froze.
"Lie to him about what?" she asked,
though she knew the answer.
"About us," he said. "The lie that we're in love. We must end it."
Emma closed her eyes.
"I know, you and Christina."
"She told me," Mark interrupted, "that Julian is in love with you." Emma didn't open her eyes, but she could still see the bright light of the torches surrounding the pavilion and the clearing burning against her eyelids. "Emma," Mark said, "it was not her fault. It was an accident. But when she spoke the words to me, I understood. None of this ever had anything to do with Cameron Ashdown, did it? You were trying to protect Julian from his own feelings. If Julian loves you, you must convince him it's impossible for you to love him back." His sympathy almost broke her. She opened her eyes. Closing them was cowardice, and the Carstairs were not cowards. "Mark, you know about the law," she said. "And you know Julian's secrets. About Arthur, the Institute. You know what would happen if anyone found out what they would do to us, to your family." "I do know," he said, "and I'm not angry with you. I would stand beside you if you found someone else to deceive him. Sometimes we must deceive the ones we love. But I cannot be the instrument that causes him pain." "But it can only be you. You think if there was anyone else, I would have asked you?" She could hear the desperation in her own voice. Mark's eyes clouded. "Why only me?"
"Because there isn't anyone else Jules is jealous of," she said, and she saw the astonishment bloom in his eyes. Just as a twig snapped behind her, she whirled, Cortana flashing out. It was Julian.
"You should know better than to draw steel on your own parabatai," he said, with a crook of a smile. She lowered the blade.
Had he heard anything she and Mark had said? It didn't look like it.
"You should know better than to make noise when you walk." "No soundless runes," said Jules, and glanced from her to Mark.
"We found a position closer to the throne. Christina's already..." But Mark had gone still. He was staring at something Emma couldn't see. Julian's gaze met hers, full of unguarded alarm, and then Mark was moving, pushing through the undergrowth.
The other two threw themselves after him. Emma could feel sweat gather in the hollow of her back as she strained herself not to step on a twig that might break, a leaf that might crack. It was painful, humbling almost, to realize how much Nephilim relied on their runes.
She came up short quickly, almost bumping into Mark. He hadn't gone that far, only to the very edge of the clearing, where he was still hidden from the view of the pavilion by an overgrowth of ferns.
Their view of the clearing was unobstructed. Emma could see the unseelie fairies gathered close in front of the throne. There were likely 100 of them, maybe more. They were dressed in stunning finery, much more elegant than she'd imagined. A woman with dark skin wore a dress made of the feathers of a swan, stark and white, a necklace of down encircling her slender throat. 2 pale men were dressed in rose silk overcoats and waistcoats of shimmering blue bird's wings. A wheat-skinned woman with hair made of rose petals approached the pavilion. Her dress, an intricate cage of the bones of small animals, fastened together with a thread made of human hair. But Mark was looking at none of them, nor was he looking at the pavilion where the unseelie princes stood, clearly waiting. Instead, he was staring at 2 of the unseelie princes, both clothed in black silk. One was tall, with deep brown skin, the skull of a raven, dipped in gold, dangling around his throat. The other was pale and black-haired, his face narrow and bearded. Slumped between them was the figure of a prisoner, his clothes blood-stained, his body limp. The crowd parted for them, their voices quiet murmurs.
"Kieran," Mark whispered.
He started forward, but Julian caught the back of his shirt, gripping his brother so tightly that his knuckles turned white.
"Not yet," he hissed under his breath.
His eyes were flat, glittering. In them, Emma saw the ruthlessness that she had once told him frightened her. Not for herself, but for him. The princes had reached a tall, white-barked tree just to the left and in front of the pavilion. The bearded prince slammed Kieran up against it hard. The prince with the raven necklace spoke to him sharply, shaking his head. The other prince laughed.
"The one with the beard,"
is Prince Erek, said Mark, the king's favorite. The other is Prince Edain. Kieran says that Edain does not like to see people hurt, but Erek enjoys it. It seemed to be true. Erek produced a rope of thorns and held it out toward Edain, who shook his head and walked away toward the pavilion. Shrugging, Erek commenced binding Kieran to the tree trunk. His own hands were protected with thick gloves, but Kieran was wearing only a torn shirt and breeches, and thorns cut into his wrists and ankles, and in his throat when Erek pulled a strand of the vicious rope tight against his skin. Through it all, Kieran slumped inertly, his eyes half-closed, clearly beyond caring. Mark tensed, but Julian held on to him. Christina had rejoined them and was pressing her hand over her mouth. She stared as Erek finished with Kieran and stepped back. Blood welled from the lacerations where the thorn bindings cut into Kieran's skin. His head had fallen back against the trunk of the tree. Emma could see his silver eye and the black one as well, both half-lidded. There were bruises on his pale skin, on his cheek and above his hip where his shirt was torn. There was a commotion atop the pavilion, and a single blast from a horn shattered the murmuring quiet in the clearing. The gentry looked up. A tall figure had appeared beside the throne. He was all in white, salt white, with a doublet of white silk and gauntlets of white bone. White horns curled from either side of his head, startling against the blackness of his hair. A gold band encircled his forehead. Christina exhaled. The king. Emma could see his profile. It was beautiful. Clear, precise, clean, like a drawing or painting of something perfect. Emma couldn't have described the shape of his eyes or cheekbones or the turn of his mouth, and she lacked Jules' ability to paint it, but she knew it was uncanny and wonderful, and that she would remember the face of the king of the Unseelie court for all her life. He turned, bringing his face into full view. Emma heard Christina gasp faintly. The king's face was divided down the middle. The right side was the face of a young man, luminous with elegance and beauty, though his eye was red as a flame. The left side was an inhuman mask, gray skin tight and leathery over bone, eye socket empty and black, mottled with brutal scars. Kieran, bound to the tree, looked once at the monstrous face of his father and turned his head away, his chin dropping, tangled black hair falling to hide his eyes. Erek hurried toward the pavilion, joining Edain and a crowd of other princes at their father's side. Mark was breathing hard. "The face of the Unseelie King," he whispered. "Kieran spoke of it, but..." "Steady," Julian whispered back. "Wait to hear what he says." As if on cue, the king spoke. "Folk of the court," he said, "we have gathered here for a sad purpose, to witness justice brought against one of the fair folk who has taken up arms and murdered another in the place of peace. Kieran Hunter stands convicted of the murder of Irloth of the Unseelie court, one of my own knights. He slew him with his blade here in the Unseelie lands." A murmur ran through the crowd. "We pay a price for the peace among our folk," said the king. His voice was like a ringing bell, lovely and echoing. Something touched Emma's shoulder. It was Julian's hand, the one that wasn't clasping Mark's arm. Emma looked at him in surprise, but he was staring ahead toward the clearing. "No Unseelie fairy shall raise a hand against another. The price of disobedience is justice. Death is paid with death." Julian's fingers moved quickly against Emma's skin through her shirt, the age-old language of their shared childhood. S-T-A-Y-H-E-R-E. She whipped around to look at him, but he was already moving.
She heard Mark's breath hiss out in the gas and caught at his wrist, preventing him from going after his brother. Under the starlight,